Good afternoon. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's, check here, 4:10. November 12th, 2007. Joining me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Dyson. This afternoon, we're going to have a walkthrough of the CS for House Bill 2001 with our legislative consultants. Also, we'll have Econ 1 via teleconference to discuss tax and revenue implications of the bill. We're going to walk through the bill, and then at the end of that, we'll have Mr. David Teal from Ledge Finance talk about some progressivity issues. And then we're going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting, pick it up, schedule for 10 a.m. tomorrow, and we'll start, or we'll continue the process. Tomorrow will probably be fairly active, and as we work to try to get the bill taken care of by our deadline, which is Friday. We'd want to be finished so we can all be home for Thanksgiving. I would like to have Mr. Steve Porter, Mr. Dan Dickinson, come forward, please. They're legislative consultants hired by Legislative Budget and Audit, which is the legislators' consultants concerning this issue and several others. You can go ahead, please, Mr. Porter, and introduce yourself for the record. And then when Mr. Dickinson starts, he can introduce himself for the record and then do your presentation. I think you're going to then walk us through the bill.
That's correct, sir. My name is Steve Porter, consultant to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Our presentation this morning will start out at, what you might say, at a higher level, talking about each one of the elements that you'll see in the legislation, their relative importance to each other. Dan will then take you through the bill itself, the changes and impacts specifically to each one of the sections. Econ 1 will then come back and do an analysis of economics associated with that bill, and then David Teal will do some analysis as well. So what I'd like to do is to remind you of our last presentation here. We talked about the value equation. It is basically value minus the costs times the tax minus the credits gives you your total value. And what we'll do this morning is start out with total value, which is, this would be the total revenue at West Coast that they receive from selling the oil. The very first thing that happens after that is the transportation costs are deducted from every barrel of oil, both the royalty barrels and the non-royalty barrels. So that is why this element is taken off first. So you can kind of keep track of the different elements as we go through. The next piece that happens is the state takes its royalty value next. And so it just continues to what you'll see is the gross production value is the value that's left over after the royalty is taken care of. The next thing that happens is you take your producer's cost, the OPEX and CAPEX from that. This is one area that has had a substantial amount of discussion in all the bills before the House and the Senate. There's been a lot of concerns around this producer's costs. All those are taken out before the production tax value is determined. The production tax value is the value upon which the tax is calculated. And that's the base production tax. The current PPT is 22.5. The new proposed tax is down covered, the 25 as proposed. The reason that we've kind of walked it through this way is to basically show you production cash flow. There have been slides that basically say producer's profit. The reason that we do not use producer's profit is that profit would suggest that you're really getting a return on your money, and so you'd have to look at all the costs of a life cycle of a project. The state tax is based on a single snapshot in a year. Whatever cash flow happens in that year, you get taxed on. So it does not really take into account the sunk costs for a project development. What you've got is CapEx for other future projects, as well as the sunk cost for past projects. So what we're doing on our tax base is really taking a snapshot each year of cash flow, and that's what your tax is against.
Steve, you just pause for a minute here. I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Senator Stevens, who was here in the beginning, also Senator Ellis, Senator French, Senator Terrio. Okay, go ahead and please continue.
Thanks, Senator Steadman. Actually, one more thing I'd just like to touch base on is, as this graph, as we continue on this graph, it's the one axis as it's shown above is price. And so in a low price world, you really get, you'll see right, actually at this point is where you'll see that margin begin to occur for your tax base. And then the revenue share, think of that as a percentage of effective rate of the tax. So that's kind of the two. You've got price on one axis and tax percentage on the other axis. The next thing that happens is something that we don't think of all the time on the as we've proceeded forward, but it's excluded costs. A lot of the discussion recently has been toward what cost should be excluded from the producer's cash flow, the producer's costs, prior to taking it from the base production tax. And what you have to remember there is those costs are actually costs that occurred. It's not that they can't really be included in the producer's cash flow because the producer's actually spent those costs, but they're not going to get credit for them against those costs. So it really comes out of their portion after the base production tax. But it's something that you need to be aware of. As you increase the excluded costs, this one element right here will continue to eat into the producer's cash flow, but should not be considered as a part of the producer's profit because they actually spent that money. So it cannot be considered a portion of what they have left. The next piece to be taken out is the corporate income tax. It is it's kind of a flat part. It's substantially less than the base production tax. We actually could show you, a graphic that shows you the relationship between royalty, base production tax, and corporate income tax. I think that was presented at one of our previous meetings before this committee. The next piece is the progressivity tax. And that's based on the price, the trigger price. If it's like say $40 or $50 or $30, whatever it is, it's the amount of cash flow per barrel that you're going to allow the producer before the progressivity tax comes in. And then the only other question is the slope of the line is based on the tax factor, whether it's 0.4 or 0.2 or whatever it happens to be on a percentage basis.
Yeah, we've also had to join us Senator Wagner and Senator Wilikowski.
The next piece that is often left out of slides is the federal government. From a total government take standpoint, the federal government gets their 35% off the top after all those calculations are made. The producer does get to deduct their state taxes against that federal, so that's why we put it up on top the way it is currently. So this is basically your cash flow model. There's two elements that are not on this slide that it is that you need to be considered as well. The property tax is not on this slide. It's 2 mils, so it's a small percent, but it is something that you need to be aware of. Also comes out of that before the cash flow. It's something that will actually increase the cash flow or any type of credits that you may have. If it's the CapEx credit, whether it's the expiration 023 credits or 025 credits, those credits will actually push this margin back down and give the producers additional cash flow. And this slide, in general, at the current price of roughly $90 a barrel, this is the rough estimate of what, who gets what where. The base tax ends up being about 22.5 to 25. The progressivity tax If it caps out at 25%, it would be roughly the same. Corporate income tax, federal tax would be on top of that. And at 90, there's an effective tax rate that I think Econ 1 will talk to in terms of what the current effective tax rate is at plus or minus $90 a barrel. With that, I'll turn the presentation over to Dan. We'll have to take just a second while we trade out memory clip.
Okay. Yes. We're going to stand at ease for a minute. Mr. Dickinson, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then continue.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dan Dickinson. I'm a CPA, and at the moment I'm consulting with LB&A on the matters that are in front of you. And what I was asked to put together here is basically to summarize the bill that passed out of the House last night. And what I've done in this analysis is compared current law in the first column to the bill that was introduced roughly 3 weeks ago, identical versions in the House and the Senate, and then the final version that passed out yesterday. The color coding, and it may not always be exactly clear because there were a bunch of columns for intermediate versions that aren't here, but basically if you see it in red, it was the current law, and so if it's in the last column, if it's in red, it's essentially unchanged. If you see it in yellow in the final column, that means it was essentially the governor's proposal unchanged, and if it's white, that means it's something that doesn't reflect either current law or the governor's proposal, and if it's white in either of the first two columns, that means it didn't really show up in further proposals. So I hope that much is clear. Let me run through these. On the first page, and these are organized by issue, and so even though the bill sections are available there, I haven't tried to put in all the cross-references and everything that's occurring to make these each piece work. The base rate is 25%. The progressivity is reflected. It has elements from the governor's proposal, from the current law, and some new elements of its own. The trigger point, in other words, how much margin is allowed on each barrel before progressivity kicked in, is from the governor's proposal, so that's at $30. Current law, as folks are probably aware, is $40. The slope, how much for each barrel that, excuse me, each dollar per barrel that you're over that starting place, how much is added to the tax, and the current the House bill has 0.4%. So every dollar adds 0.4%. That's double the governor's proposal, and the current law is 0.25%. It is calculated on a monthly basis. It isn't paid until the end of the year, but the calculation is on a monthly basis. And finally, it is applied to the net with a cap of 25% of net. And Mr. Chairman, if I might take a minute and look at the language of the bill, because one of the problems, and this happened to me when I was first handed the amendment and looked at it, it's worth looking at some of the language in the bill because, let's just look at it, and I think you can see that.
What I'd like to do, just for general information for the committee, is have Mr. Dickinson walk through the bill and hold our questions until the end. And let him finish the presentation, then we can back up, deal with some questions, and then we'll go on to Econ 1 and Barry Pullum.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you have a copy of the bill, the finance amended bill that came out on page 12, section G deals with a progressivity just like it does in the current under current statute. And if you read it, and I'm for example going to read basically from lines 25 down through 29, what it says is the monthly production tax value, and that's the defined term, calculated in the manner described in 160A. So that's how you're going to calculate what you're taking the progressivity against, except that, and so you can put a quotation mark in here, the gross value at the point of production for the month is substituted for, and then we'll do another quotation, the gross value at the point of production for the calendar year. In other words, the way the base for the tax is calculated in 160 is you take your gross value and you subtract from it your costs to come up with a net value. And what the statute is saying here is when you do that on a monthly basis, you go to where that calculation is described on an annual basis, and you replace the gross value calculated for the year with the gross value calculated at the month. But it's still the first step in 160, and you're still going to subtract your costs. So I think some people, glancing at this, you might read this and say, oh, it's talking about, you know, you can find the language here that says the gross value at the point of production. But the point is, if you have to sort of follow this back through to 160A, and this really is, it remains, the progressivity is a tax on the net value, or the production tax value, as the defined term is in the statute. So those are the issues for progressivity. Moving down to the floor remains, it's very hard to see through the red on the screen here, but the floor remains as it is under current law. That is to say, it's a single floor calculated on the north slope. Credits can still be applied against the floor if they're available, and the rate ranges from 0 to 4%. The one difference, and I'll get to this later, has to do if there are gas sales from the north slope for use in state. Moving down to the next section, which are the investment credits, or the credits found in 023. The provision in current law that says that they can be taken as soon as the year in which they are made, in other words, the credit shows up in that year, that remains. However, the percentage at which a loss, if you take all your, after all your deductions, you have a negative value, the way that's carried forward, that has been changed and reflects the governor's proposal in ACES, which is at 25%. It's the same rate. So if I'm a major producer and I have lots of things that I can take my deductions against, lots of production, I would get 25%. If I were a new entrant who was spending money but not yet able to capitalize, or not yet able to, or didn't have to pay taxes, so I couldn't use my credits yet, I'm only getting 20%. So I think this equalizes those two. Finally, the third piece in the 023 credits are the TIE, or transitional investment expenditures. And the proposal, or the bill that's in front of you, what that does is it effectively cuts off transitional investment expenditures, the ability to use those, as of December 31st, 2007. So for the 1 year and 9 months until the bill takes effect, those transitional investment expenditures would be allowed. And that essentially reflects the governor's proposal as well. The difference is, what the bill in front of you says is, if you had investment, three buckets we have to go through. If you made investments between March 31st, 2001 and 2006, then you have some money in your TIE credits. That was the baseline. You had to have capital spending there. The second thing that has to happen is you have to match that on a two-for-one basis with spending between April 1st, 2006 and December 31st, 2007. In other words, the producers who had production now, that's what they were able to do, and then the law changed. And so what the bill in front of you says is, well, if you were someone who were also making investments, but you didn't have production yet, so you couldn't take the credits, we'll calculate the amount that you can take the same. Everybody gets this 21-month period in which their investments will count, but you can hold on to them until you have production. And so if someone's been making investments and they're going to come into production next year or the year after, that's when they can take their TIE credits. So it's really been described as trying to, if people were making investments in this last 23-month period that we're in now, expecting a TIE credit, it essentially allows that to go forward. Moving on to the exploration credits, which are sections or 025 in the law. I think, as folks remember, these predate the PPT. They were put in place in 2003, and the exploration credits were 20% under certain conditions and 40% under certain conditions. When the PPT came in, basically the same sets of rules would apply. In the 20, if you were exploring, you could apply for it under 025 or under 023. What this, the legislation in front of you says is, well, let's raise that to 30%. So the sort of the exploration piece gets a 30% credit as opposed to development and production capital investments, which will remain at the 20%. Among the things that are disallowed when you're applying for those credits, there's a general admission already in statute for what's it, G&A, general and admin costs, and what's been added to that and then harmonized with a description in another place in the bill. Basically, it says if the credit or the dollars arise because of a criminal act, fraud, criminal negligence, something like that, it is disallowed. So it's an explicit standard tied to bad acts, which are defined as criminal acts. Under this situation, the DNR will take a more active role. Basically, a producer will come in, say what they want to do. DNR will look at that and say, yeah, that meets, you'll meet the standard. It makes sense. That's something that hasn't been explored for before. Then they'll go out, they'll do the exploration, then come back, and DNR will then check off and say, yes, they met the, I think the language basically says that they essentially, what they did was consistent with the goals that they had earlier described to DNR. In addition, if you are outside of the Cook Inlet, your exploration has to be 3 miles from, the bottom hole of that exploration well has to be 3 miles from any other pre-existing exploration well. On the confidentiality of the data, currently it is, or well data, excuse me, not seismic data, but well data, currently is 10 years. The governor proposed that go to 2 years. That's in the bill that you have in front of you. However, a couple of exceptions are set up. One of them is if the commissioner of DNR thinks it would adversely affect a lease sale, he can withhold that information so it's not public. In another case, if a private landowner, a company came in and shot seismic and the private landowner doesn't want that information to become public, the landowner can also withhold their permission. And that really gets down to the second point, the next point down here, which is the seismic on non-state land. There is an explicit clause whereby a private landowner can withhold their permission, and so the lessee, the person shooting the seismic, if you will, would not be able to apply for the credit under those terms. For pre-existing wells, what the bill in front of you does is expands the what's allowed to get this 30% credit. They were very strict before. Basically, if you went in one season and you drilled a well and you found oil and you wanted to figure out how much was there and you wanted to drill delineation wells, the next season those delineation wells would not qualify. Under this current language, you basically have 540 days or two drilling seasons, sort of two winters and a year in between, in which you will all qualify for the 30%. And finally, the last piece is the other transitional investment expenditures, ones that were made for seismic. Anything prior to 2003, if the DNR commissioner decides it's in the best interest of the state to acquire that information, and then ultimately would be made public, they can offer a TIE to anyone for up to 5% of the costs incurred to get that seismic data. Overall, there is one additional exception to tax credits, and this applies to any of them. And the notion there is if there is an unpaid judgment, the state will withhold the credits, and there are some other conditions which maybe the lawyers can go through a little cleaner, but basically if you're appealing the judgment and you file a bond or some other way, some of the mechanisms by which that are required, so the dollars are transferred to the court, then you can go ahead and use your credits. But while there is an unpaid judgment and the company retains the dollars in that judgment, the state can withhold the ability to use the credits. Moving ahead to the state purchase of the credits, that essentially retains the structure found in the current law. That is, it simply says that appropriations will be made by law. There is no fund created, as was suggested in the governor's proposal. There is a limit of $25 million per taxpayer. However, in the current bill, the ARM board is authorized to purchase those credits, and then the state would purchase the credits from the ARM board. And at least in the reading, there doesn't appear to be a structure whereby there would be any limit there. So the limit, if a taxpayer sold to the Arm Board and the Arm Board sold to the state, that limit might not apply. Or I believe that limit would not apply. The next section has to do with allowable lease expenditures, or more prosaically, costs that are deductible. And the entire structure of that, if you will, has been changed. Section 165 A and B have been thoroughly rewritten, and what you essentially have now is a situation where before a cost can be deducted, the state of Alaska has to authorize it through regulations. And so you're basically going to have regulations in place that at some level of specificity will say what is allowed and what is not. One of the ideas behind the structuring of costs was the notion that for the major, most of the oil that's produced, you're in units. Units have working interest owners. Operators actually operate the units, and the working interest owners look over their shoulder, audit them, fight about the dollars being spent. There was two sections of the current law sort of create the framework by which those audits and those unit interests, unit operating agreements can be used. That language is repealed. However, when the state goes in and writes its regulations, it can certainly use some of those things as well. And in fact, one of the things explicitly that the state should be looking at when it does those regulations are unit operating agreements that were negotiated when you had parties that actually had the ability to negotiate who had real dollars at stake. So that's changing from essentially an explicit ability to an implicit ability. The next thing down are what bad acts. There's a list of criminal acts that if the costs arise from those or arise from having to replace or repair because of criminal acts, then those costs are not allowable as deductions. And if they're not allowable as deductions, it follows through they're not allowable as credits. Dispute resolution, and actually where you see on this graph, you see all three red. What that means is essentially the current law, the governor's proposal, and what came into effect are all the same, but there were some intermediate steps. Some of the intermediate committee bills would have had something different in them, so no change there. There's a series of costs that I've categorized here as public outreach costs. I believe they were not explicitly disallowed under current law. Other tests may or may not have cut them out, but under current law they are listed and those are removed from the ability to take them. The final item under costs is maybe one of the more radical changes in this, and that is that operating costs, the costs you deduct for operating the lease, are going to be determined on a formulaic basis. The basic idea is you'll go in and say, what were your costs in 2006? And then every year thereafter, that will increase by 3%. So you basically create a baseline, and then the cost will go up by 3%. Now, if this will apply to the legacy fields, those that have produced more than a billion barrels, which is going to be restricted to Prudhoe and Kuparuk, and at least as I read it, if there were shutdowns, not ones that came from criminal negligence or the things that are forbidden, but if there were scheduled shutdowns, maintenance, volume fell, then the cost per barrel would probably be rising much more quickly than 3%. So the key idea is you form your base in 2006 and then a 3% adjustment upwards every year after that. If when the state goes in and audits and they determine that there was an overstatement and that overstatement was more than 10%, then all the subsequent years that were driven by that formula will also have to be recalculated. Now, if I can make one other observation on the law, when you look at it, what it says is you take your costs in 2006, and in the first year you multiply that times 137%, and then 3% thereafter. And the mechanics of that are, in the first year, because the law was only in effect from April 1st through December 31st, you'll only actually have 9 months of a total year's worth of costs. And so mechanically, if I took 100% and multiplied it times 3, or I took 100%, took it down to 75%, and then multiplied times 137%, I would get to the same place. But the idea is it's a 3% increase based on your 2006 costs. The information pieces that run through this, and there's quite a number of bill sections. The bill still requires, as the governor asked for, the ability that forward-looking information be provided to help the state forecast. The one difference in the bill before you that's different from the proposal is, before a $1,000 a day penalty provided for it can be assessed, the state needs to say, we want this document. The producer refuses to give it, and at that point, the $1,000 assessment can occur. What can't happen is you can't come in 6 years after the event, during the audit, find a document and say, oh, if you had produced that 6 years ago, we could have had a better forecast. It was necessary. Therefore, here's your bill for $2 million because we didn't have it for the intervening 6 years. You have to say, we want the document and not get it, and that's what the $1,000 a day applies. On the disclosure of tax information, under the current law, there's a general rule that says tax information cannot be revealed, huge penalties. One of the exceptions that's created is if you reveal statistical information that's aggregated in such a way that it doesn't reveal the particulars of a given taxpayer. What the ACES proposed to do is say, well, you can combine the data from two other taxpayers, so you have three taxpayers aggregated together, and you're out from under the umbrella. In other words, if you put three taxpayers together and it doesn't disguise the affairs of one of them, so for example, if I took Doyon, BP, and NANA, which is my belief is anyone looking at the revenue sources book and the size of the leases can conclude are among the largest and the smallest of the taxpayers, essentially it would be BP's data, would that be prohibited or not? It is my belief under the statute in front of you that would still be prohibited, but that may be an issue of, I mean, there may simply be something that when all the amendments were put in, this didn't quite work out as intended. There is still the general provision that says you can't reveal information about a particular taxpayer, and if you publish aggregate information, it has to be in such a way that it does not reveal the particulars of a taxpayer. So that general provision is still in effect. In the governor's proposal, there was an exception carved out of that. The bill in front of you does not have that exception, but it does require that taxpayer information for three taxpayers be combined. On all the other provisions, and there are 10 or 12 of them in the bill that relate to the sharing of information between DNR and DOR, those are all identical to the governor's proposal, and I think as everyone's aware, the idea is when there's confidential information, if DNR gets confidential information from DOR, they're under the same strictures that the Department of Revenue would be. It's a felony to release it, so on and so forth. So those, and that structure essentially remains unchanged from the governor's proposal. The statute of limitations, currently 3 years for all taxes, the production tax will be carved out and go to a 6-year statute of limitations. For Department of Revenue auditors and additional auditors in the Department of Natural Resources, the governor's proposal was that they be made exempt, taken out of the classified service. And what the bill in front of you does is it creates 6 new positions for master auditors, who will be in the exempt classification, but the folks they lead who will be doing the actual work, the ticking, the tying, the things you do in an audit, will remain in the classified service. The effective date of the bill is January 1st, 2008, so it's generally forward-looking. The one issue that may be worth flagging is there is intent language, and again, I may turn over to the lawyers on this one, but there's intent language that says the situation that folks have generally discussed about the corrosion issues, that's what we meant when we were talking about the things that were prohibited. And I'll let, I'll let attorneys dig into what, you know, how that works. But if you look at the bill per se, there is nothing that is retroactive in it. Downstream costs have also been changed, and this was a proposal that was not in the governor's original ACES proposal. And what it basically says is, for downstream costs, in other words, the cost to get it from pump station 1 or from the North Slope down to where it sold, Los Angeles on the West Coast. Those costs are going to be the lower of the actual or the reasonable costs. And then it gives further definition for what's going on within pipelines. And basically, when you're looking at reasonable costs, prima facie evidence of a reasonable cost is something which is has been adjudicated as a just and reasonable. That means there's been a dispute, and the RCA or the FERC has said, here's an answer that's just and reasonable. And it's an arm's length transaction, and again, that may be a drafting issue. I'm not quite sure when you've got evidence of something, if you have an and in there, how that works. But the general idea, not to get down into the details, is both for tankers and for the pipeline, it's going to be the lower of the actual costs. And for tankers, we've always been in a situation where the tanker company and the company shipping the oil are the same. Ever since the Exxon Valdez, there's been a very, very thin market for other folks involved because liabilities are so high. And we've always looked through that transaction, tried to look at the actual cost. But for TAPS tariffs and upstream pipelines, the department has always been limited to the filing, what has been there. And as folks are probably aware, for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that was the TSM or the TAPS settlement methodology, and it was never adjudicated one way or the other. Now,
stop for a second. I just want the record to reflect that Senator Green's had joined us here about 15, 20 minutes ago. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so now that for the pipelines as well, TAPS and the upstream, not the upstream, but the pipelines that get from Kuparuk or from other fields to Pump Station 1, it will be the lower of actual or reasonable. Again, we will then be looking through the transaction of BP shipping on BP pipeline. We find out what are BP's actual costs. The gas ceilings in Cook Inlet that are applied through 2022 basically look back at a one-year period from the 1 year before the PPT was passed and said whatever price and whatever tax rate you use then, that's what you'll continue to use. And what the bill in front of you says is you average all Cook Inlet together, you find out what the average rate, sort of the ceiling is as a consequence of this bill, and if there is other gas produced anywhere else in the state for in-state use, then it gets that same rate, that same basic, what is now a three-year-old Cook Inlet rate. You'll see a lot of the language in here has to do with the fact that it potentially you could have, for example, gas produced on the North Slope, say sent to Fairbanks, truck to Fairbanks, something like that. So you'd have a situation where you have both a ceiling and a floor applying, and it just mechanically as a tax matter, you could have a situation in where you had a ceiling and the floor was above it. And so the taxpayer would say, well, you can't pay below this and you can't pay above this, what do you pay? And so there's just a language. One of the technicalities of getting this all drafted together is a language that says, in that case, you're limited by the ceiling, you don't pay the floor. In terms of penalties, as the red band across there says, there was some change on this in some intermediate versions, but not in the bill in front of you. Prior to March 31st of any year, you're making 12 payments, monthly estimated payments, and the interest that is applied to those, both underpayments and interest payments, we simply go to the IRS rules, and whatever those are, those apply. March 31st is when the state rate applies, and that is 11% compounded quarterly. In addition, there has now been in place in this bill in front of you an additional penalty for underreporting. And what that basically says is if a taxpayer underreports by 10% or $10 million, then there's a 10% assessment on the amount that is underpaid. If they underpay by 20% or $20 million, then there's a 20% a payment. And you know, as I think about modeling this, it's my belief that penalty will essentially be automatic if at current price levels. If you think about the world today where these taxes would raise over $2.5 billion, so three large taxpayers, each one's roughly in the $800 million range, I mean, using these very vague numbers, typically are there going to be conflicts of more than $20 million? Typically, yeah, I think so. When you're doing an $800 million payment. Are there going to be issues that arise to a couple of percentage points? And I think there will be. So I think essentially these penalties will become automatic. Perhaps I'm wrong on that. And certainly at lower prices, that same logic would not apply. In the intent language, there are three areas that deal with intent. The first one is a statement which deals with the overall fairness, the ability to assess tax fairly. There is also specific language dealing with the statute of limitations and how the department has interpreted that. And they're changing the law, but they don't want an argument to be raised, well, you changed the law, so it must have meant something different beforehand. So they're just saying that this change in the law simply makes clear what the department's long-term standing has been. And finally, the third issue deals with this ceiling issue, and it is the intent of the body passing this bill to say that where the ceilings are on gas, that saving should be passed through to consumers. Just to use my prior example, if you had gas on the North Slope that was being shipped to Fairbanks, the company that delivered it to Fairbanks might be regulated by the RCA, but the company selling and getting the tax break on the North Slope might not be. And so the intent is to hope that would flow through. The final set of four issues up here are grouped together as administrative issues. They come from different places in the bill. The first one deals to the minor technicality, but it's actually a major rewrite in the bill, having to do with monthly payments, where the ceiling's applied. And under current law, you can't apply the ceiling in your monthly payment, or there's some question about whether you do or not, and so you'd make a payment at the high payment, and then at the end of the year, you'd get your refund with interest. And then, so what this basically says is, no, you can come in and you pay at the ceiling on your monthly estimated payments. That makes sense. There is a bill, or part of this bill says that the department will notify the legislature every year about how much money was generated by progressivity. And when those prices are high, up to $50 million of that may be appropriated to pay for LIHEAP, or the Low Income Heating Energy Assistance Program. In addition, there is language to deal with whistleblowers. It creates an ability for a whistleblower to get up to $1 million or 10% of the amount that the whistleblowing caught. There are limitations in there for bad faith. I guess the notion is you don't want people sending an email to the Department of Revenue every day saying so-and-so is cheating on their taxes, and then when that person ends up with a judgment or something, they say, well, I want my share of the refund. The lawyers have debated some of the whistleblower aspects, and I won't repeat those arguments here. There is a specific provision which allows DNRs, if they rewrite their NPSL, their net profit share lease regulations, to go retroactive. I think folks are looking at the interaction of the PPT's progressivity and the NPSL. It also has a very similar profits element. And finally, there is a report under current law required in 2011 as to how things have worked, whether it's had the objectives, the investment, revenues, all those things have come out. And that language is repealed in this bill. One important point, and I think it was maybe literally a mechanical issue. One of the amendments that had the fixed costs, that fixed your operating costs, fixed the taxpayer's operating costs, also required a report in 2011 to see whether that fixed number was deviating very much from the actual number. In the mechanics of how things got repealed, et cetera, that disappeared. But I believe it was the intent that be in the bill. It went into a section, and that section got repealed, and so it's not in the draft in front of you. But I think it was the intent that be there, and so that may be a mechanical issue of how those amendments are interpreted. So that, Mr. Chairman, is a maybe slightly less brief than you hoped for a summary of what you see in the bill in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Questions from the committee? Senator Elton.
Just a real quick question. It's on page 2 of your slide, Mr. Dickinson. Under exceptions to tax credits, the unpaid judgment component, I'm going to assume that would apply to the Exxon Valdez, but would not apply to Point Thompson.
Senator Elton, You know, I don't know. I can report a conversation in the House Finance in which a similar question was asked if the commissioner could describe one of these, and he said nothing came to his mind. So I'll just repeat that conversation, and you may ask that clarification from someone else.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, this is probably out of your area of expertise, but someone has represented to me that it's really important for these high-level auditors to have protection so that they cannot be disciplined for disagreeing with the boss, and that they need to have the freedom to stand up and say, you're ignoring something really important. But does the whistleblower protection extend to those guys?
Thank you, Senator. That's a good point. Employees of the state of the Alaska and their agents, I mean, I have all the legal terms, are excluded from the Whistleblower Act. In other words, an auditor couldn't go and do the audit and go, whoa, big item here, I'm resigned, and then the next day show up and ask to be a whistleblower. So the whistleblower protection that's in here explicitly excludes Department of Revenue employees or state employees.
You have a follow-up, Senator?
Yeah, so, but if he stays in employment and keeps saying to the boss, you're ignoring something really important here, what protection do they have? Do they have any protection under whistleblower? Do they have any protection?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, the auditors, yes, would remain under the civil service, and so they could only be removed for cause. The master auditors,
yes,
presumably could be removed merely because they were, you know, troublesome to the administration's overall vision or something. But that's the distinction that's created.
Yep. I don't like your answer, but I think you're right.
Well, Senator, you may ask an attorney to see whether I got that right, but I think that's the...
Yeah, thank you.
We have
Mr. Porter is an attorney, and do you have anything to say on this, Steve?
Senator Dyson, the chair, the application is correct. The risk is there. Generally, these auditors are in the professional ranks, and that would normally not occur. But can you think of a circumstance under which it could occur? You have actually identified one.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions? We'll go ahead and move on to Mr. Barry Pulliam from Econ One. Is he still online?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You should have, for the record, this is Barry Pulliam, Econ One Research, consultant to the legislature. You should have four charts there in front of you, and some of these are going to look familiar to the charts that I prepared and we talked about just a couple of days ago.
Barry, can you hold on a minute? We're going to take a quick at ease while we get those charts out.
Okay.
Back on the record, Senate time, I guess, a quick moment. Pulliam ended up to be a couple of moments. If you could, we've all got copies of your four slides, and it's up on the overhead, so if you could please walk through them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was saying, these charts, at least some of them are going to be similar to ones we discussed last week. We have, since I was up there last week, of course, the DOR has come out with some new volume projections and some new cost projections that go along with those volume projections. The analyses that are presented in these charts all reflect those new volume and cost projections. So these are they incorporate the fall 2007 volume. So they will be, even for some of the plans we talked about last week, what you see here will be a little bit different, reflecting the updated volume and cost forecast. The first chart that you have there is the entitled Estimated Average Effective Tax Rate on Gross Taxable Value at Various West Coast A&S Price Levels. And again, this is a chart that we showed last week. Here I've put in the House bill that passed last night and shown that in, that's the green line that you have. I think all of the other lines that are on this chart are ones that we had last week, the PPT, SB 2001, and Senate Judiciary CS, and then the PPT expected. And just a quick refresher, the difference between the PPT and PPT expected is really the cost issues. So the dashed line, the PPT expected, incorporates the cost as expected last year, while the solid black line, the PPT, incorporates the cost as currently expected. All of these use the same volume forecast, which are the fall 2007 forecast. A couple items to note on this chart. You'll see that the green line, the House bill, and the blue line, the Senate Judiciary CS, are pretty close to each other, and that is because they incorporate a lot of the same elements. They have the same 25% tax rate, and they have the same progressivity feature, 0.4% per dollar over a $30 net. And in addition, they each top out at a 50% overall tax rate. They fall below at low prices, the SB 2001 line, because they don't have the same gross floor that SB 2001 has. But they rise more quickly, as you see, over about $55 a barrel. They rise more quickly than SB 2001 because of the higher progressivity factor. Essentially, the House bill and the Senate Judiciary have double the progressivity factor that SB 2001 does. You'll notice that the House bill is actually a little bit lower here than the Senate Judiciary, and that is due largely to the fact that it doesn't have any retroactive element to it. So we've shown here average results for fiscal year 2008 through 2014. As I understand it, the Senate Judiciary CS would apply retroactively so that the full fiscal year 2008 would be covered, whereas the House bill would begin in January. So that's going to give you a little bit of a difference between those two. Another important difference to note, and Dan touched on it, was that the House bill does incorporate some deemed operating cost numbers for Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. We do not, as I talked last week, we do not have access here at Econ 1 to the operating cost figures for 2006 that were filed for Prudhoe or Kuparuk. We have the overall North Slope numbers. We have estimated the Prudhoe and Kuparuk numbers as well as the costs in aggregate for the other fields, and have applied those estimates in this analysis. What you see coming out of the Department of Revenue may be a little bit different because they have the actual numbers by field that are filed. The next chart is entitled Estimated Total Government Share at Various West Coast A&S Price Levels. We've talked about government share before. I don't think I've shown this chart before. This is just this information is the same information that shows up on the more detailed data table that I have provided. But here you've got the government share information in tabular form. I mean, I'm sorry, in chart form, so you can get a maybe a little better visual. again, the green, the House bill line, and the Senate Judiciary line are very similar here. Each of these tax plans is generally progressive, with the government share rising at higher price levels, at least over the $55 level. Prior to that, they are slightly regressive, despite the fact that the systems all are all designed to have a to be a progressive tax and have a higher government share at higher prices. In general, you've got all of the systems here with an overall progressive feature to them. The next chart is another look at government take. It's entitled Estimated Marginal Government Share at Various West Coast ANS Price Levels. We talked about this statistic last week as well. Again, I didn't have a graph on it. I had data that I presented, but we've turned that into a graphical form so you can see the information a little better. And let me go back and just remind everybody what the marginal share is. What we calculate this figure, what we're talking about is the percentage of revenue that will flow to the government, be it federal or state, when prices rise by a dollar a barrel at any given price level. So, for instance, if you look at the blue and the green lines, again, they're very similar to each other because those two proposals have the same features or similar features. But look at the $80 level there. What that's telling you is that at $80, if prices go from $80 to $81 and nothing else changes, that the share of the increased revenue from $80 to $81, government would take about 80% of that and industry would keep about 20% of that. A couple of things to note here. You'll see that on all of these plans, the take figures increase until you get to a level that's a little bit over 85%, and then they start to decline. The reason for the increase, of course, is that we have increasing progressivity. So as each dollar under all of these plans, as prices go up, the overall tax rate goes up. And you'll notice that the lines in each case are basically linear. There's some blips in there due to changing cost levels at different prices. But basically, you've got linear increases going up until you hit a point just over $85%. And then they all decrease. Again, the increase is due to the progressivity feature of each. The decrease is due to the fact that all of these provisions have a cap to them. And they all basically cap out at 50%, with the exception of the current PPT, which caps out at, I think, 47.5% total. A couple of items to note along those lines: the Senate and the House bill, because they have, the Senate Judiciary CS and the House bill, because they have the higher progressivity at 0.4, will reach that higher marginal take sooner than the current PPT or SB 2001. And they'll reach it at about a point that would be on average over the next 6 years. If you had $100 ANS prices on the West Coast on average, you would reach that point, and then your cap would start to come in. And at higher prices, you would have lower marginal takes. The other plans get up to about that same level, but because the progressivity is not as steep, you don't get there until higher prices out beyond $120 or $140. The last chart that you have in front of you is something that, again, that I presented last week. It shows numerically in the top three boxes, you've got the figures that go behind the three charts that we just went through, effective tax rates, government share, and marginal share. The bottom box shows the estimated revenue impact relative to the current PPT of each of the different proposals. And what you see there is again the blue and the green, the Judiciary CS and the House bill have very similar figures all across the different price levels, with the House bill being slightly lower as a result of the fact that it starts in January of 2008 and doesn't cover the full fiscal year. But each, and you'll also note in here that it, beginning at $80 a barrel, the Senate Judiciary CS and the House bill both would have significant revenue impacts over and above what SB 2001 has. And with that, I'm open to any questions.
Mr. Perlman, could you talk to us a little bit or explain to us how in your modeling you handle CapEx and OpEx as the price deviates off of, I think, a $60 mark?
Yes. The operating costs and capital costs are fixed at a $60 reference level and then allowed to deviate from that point. So if prices rise over and above $60, then both capital and operating costs increase. If prices fall below $60, capital and operating costs decrease. They operate with a one-year lag. So if prices change from one year to the next, costs will change in the following year. The relationship for CapEx is larger than it is for OpEx. So, and on CapEx, the way that we've modeled it is it's consistent with the assumptions that the Department of Revenue uses and consistent with the modeling that is going to result in the fiscal notes that you see coming from them. The specific figures for capital are that if prices go up by 1%, then capital spending would go up by 0.3% the following year. Likewise, if prices go down by 1%, capital spending would go down by 0.3% the following year. The relationship for operating costs is that for every percent increase in price over $60, operating costs would go up the following year by 0.2%. And for every percent decrease, operating costs would go down the following year by 0.2%.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions for Econo? Okay, I'll just call it Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So obviously the chart is fairly clear. If in fact, I just wanted to make sure, since other people are not able to view those that might be listening in, the chart indicates that the PPT expected outperforms everything other than a price range somewhere from 95 to 122. Is that?
You're looking at the first chart, Senator?
No, I'm looking at your last page where you're showing the money.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's right. The PPT expected would be generally higher, except for the range between about, well, it'll probably break about $90, and the 90 to 120 level. and then it would be higher at other levels. Last week when I was there, we talked about the assumptions in the PPT expected, and one thing I think it's important to keep in mind when you look at these is that the analysis that went into and the forecasting that was done last year with respect to PPT really focused on a more narrow price band that topped out at about $75-$80 a barrel. And if there really wasn't a lot of expectation that prices would be up in the $100 plus range, and accordingly not, I don't think, a lot of effort into looking at what would happen to costs if you were consistently above that range. I think there was certainly a recognition that if you were in those much higher prices for any sort of extended period, or if the market expected high prices for an extended period, that that would lead to some higher costs. And so the revenue estimates there, certainly at those higher prices, I think are going to be, they're going to be too high. But what you have here really reflects in large part the assumption of a fixed cost world, and that's I think what's being modeled now with the current proposals is a much more realistic way to do it.
Thank you. Just one other thing, and I can assume from your charts all start at $40 Alaska, Alaska West Coast, Alaska North Slope West Coast price, and we assume that's your prediction, is that it will never get below 40.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, my prediction isn't that it would never get below 40. I think it is unlikely that we will be, certainly in this time period, in a situation where the average price on the West Coast is lower than that. It doesn't mean that it couldn't happen with changes that are unexpected in the world, but I think the expectation that I have, and I think generally shared by analysts, is that it would be unlikely that you would get into a price environment, certainly in the 2008-2014 period, that would put you down below $40.
Thank you.
We have any other questions from Mr. Pullman? Thank you for your presentation, and I'm sure we'll be contacting you tomorrow for continued analysis as we go forward the next couple of days and wrap this up.
All right. You're very welcome.
We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up with Ledge Finance. Back to order. What we're going to do now is we're going to have a presentation by Mr. David Teal, head of Legislative Finance Division, who helps us with all kinds of numeric data analysis. And what we have here, we're going to walk through a progressivity that will appear when we roll out a CS. And I just want to let people know what we're looking at so they can review it, think about it, and deal with information as they see fit. Mr. Teal, if you'd go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead and walk us through your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. A lot of this you've already gone through with Mr. Porter and Mr. Dickinson, but I just wanted to review some major provisions of any tax system. The first question is, what's tax? Usually that's gross or net revenue. Base rate, surcharge, trigger points, and maximum rates are the other important determinants of how much money you're going to raise. Comparison very similar to what Mr. Dickinson had here. You can show the rates, the triggers, the maximums, etc. Now, all of these systems that we're discussing today are based on net cash flow. I was under the impression at one point that the House bill was based on gross, and I think that after reviewing the language, we do agree that it's on net cash flow as opposed to gross. But again, just looking at some of these, PPT has a base rate of 22.5%. ACES, Senate Judiciary, and the House versions all raise that base rate to 25%. The plan that you asked me to run for you for the potential committee substitute brings that base rate back to 22.5%. Currently, under PPT, the trigger is at $40. All of the other proposals have a trigger at $30. Those rates vary. Under PPT, the progressivity is 0.25. ACES would have reduced it. Senate Judiciary and the House brought it back to 40. And Senate Finance has multiple triggers and multiple rates, as you can see across the bottom there. And then the maximum rates over to the right. PPT was at 47.5, the others are at 50. Senate Finance is capped at 75, but actually never gets above 50%, so effectively you could argue that that cap is also around 50%. What we're going to look at on some charts here, three different ways to look at the systems. One is increase in revenue, next is total revenue, and then the government share. And I know you've been warned about this before, but I have to say it again, that when you're looking at these graphs or at any of the model output, remember that this is a snapshot. Things like monthly take versus annual take and credit delays and things like that don't even show up in the modeling efforts. So that would require a time series, which is a much more complicated model. So really what you're looking at are a bunch of graphs that, for instance, it would take a real sharp set of eyes to even see the difference between the lines as you went from the fall forecast to the spring forecast. The numbers do change, but the shapes and relative position to the line are the same. So looking first at increases in revenue under the systems, first we have ACES graphed here. And as we go through these, PPT is the baseline. It's zero. So what we're looking at is the amount of revenue produced relative or in addition to PPT. So what ACES has is this progressivity of a base rate of 25% instead of PPT's 20%. So in this lower part of the curve, that's due completely to the change in the base rate. This little kick up at low rates is the gross floor under ACES. And then as you move to this range, you see the effect of the trigger falling from $40, which is essentially a market price of $65, to a trigger price at a market of $55, which is 30 net value price. So in this neighborhood, you're looking at the impact of a trigger. It essentially flattens out and produces somewhere between $400 and $500 million a year more than PPT. And then as you go out further, the progressivity reduction to 20% makes it so that they generate just about the same revenue. And I guess you could argue that at a certain point, ACES falls slightly below PPT. And then out here way at the end is the difference in the maximum. PPT has a maximum of 47% and ACES has a maximum rate of 50%. Adding the line for Senate Judiciary, we show the same 25% base rate, but at the trigger point, you kick in a much higher progressivity, 40% instead of 20%, so you get much more revenue much more quickly. It reaches a cap here at 50% tax rate, but PPT continues to climb. It's a longer, slower climb. so that it looks like revenue may be declining, it's actually remains at 50% tax rate, while PPT's rate continues to go up. And eventually, ACES and Senate Judiciary produce the same amount of revenue when both of them are at 50% at very, very high oil prices. I didn't put House on there specifically as a separate chart because the House version prints right on top of the Senate Judiciary version. Again, both have a base rate of 25%, the same progressivity, the same maximums. They are effectively the same tax provisions. So what's graphed here is the dark line, which is the Senate Finance potential committee substitute. It produces the same amount of revenue as PPT does with a 22% base rate until you reach that trigger point, at which point progressivity is high, as much as 0.6, and then it begins to taper off slightly in this range, producing, you know, somewhere between $1 billion and $1.7 billion in the current price range, more than PPT produces. Where others reach their maximum at 50%, PPT continues to climb at this 0.1% progressivity, so holds flat at very high oil prices. Going to the second way of looking at things, which is total revenue, that first chart confuses some people because you see a downward turn in revenue and you think, well, we're losing money. You're not. Revenue continues to climb with prices, and here you can see that PPT is low, ACES is a general shift upward at this part of the range, and the Senate Judiciary House versions are higher revenue at lower oil prices, but then the high progressivity in the Senate Finance begins to catch up, and probably about at the $90 range, they produce the same revenue. And expanding this to the higher prices, you can see that progressivity continues to climb and this committee substitute produces more revenue than the others. And again, the difference here is the 47% cap on PPT, 50% cap here, and this goes above 50%. The third way of looking at this at a system is the government share of revenue. PPT has the lowest government take. ACES is higher because of the higher base, lower progressivity, causes it to produce about the same out here at high oil prices. The House version shifts up, and Senate Judiciary as well, they're the same line, shift up to 25% base, higher government take. Progressivity brings that up, and then it flattens out, essentially levels out somewhere in the 74% range. Well, the Senate Finance Committee almost follows PPT, but this slight difference here is due to the reasonable transportation costs. We're assuming that that's going to fall to about $5 or so, so it falls approximately $2. It's just an estimate to show that it does have an effect. Then the high progressivity reaches about the same government take, but continues with the 0.1% progressivity. So we'll continue to make money beyond this $115 or so dollar place where the other tax systems flatten out.
Mr. Teal, do you have any questions for Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I suspect that this is a dumb question, but on this final chart here, when we're looking at Senate Finance, there it says net surcharge 0.6, 0.5, 0.35, 0.1, and trigger 30, 50, 70, 90. What does that mean?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, it means that progressivity begins at $30 and the rate is 0.6. At $50, it drops to 0.5. At 70, it drops to 0.35, and beyond 90, it's 0.1. So that the effect of that, I think you can probably see best in these charts, where Senate Judiciary has a fixed 0.4. Notice the slope of the line is up. It's an exponential shape to that curve, where by having multiple trigger points, you get rid of that upward curve, and in fact, you begin to slowly turn down, and you can barely see the turns. But it makes it so there's a smoother transition between the points, so you don't get this peak. It's just a way to make the curve smoother.
Yeah, what was confusing me was just the language surpate charge instead of percentage, and all right, thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Teal, I may be missing something obvious, but if you look at the chart on page 8 that you have up, and it seems like the crossover point for Senate Finance is about $75. And at that point, the Senate Finance with the surcharges as outlined seems to be better when it comes to increases in total state revenue. And then you go to the next chart on page 9, and you don't see, I mean you don't really see a crossover point or total state revenue under the various scenarios. I mean, why is that? Why, if on page 8 you see a crossover point at $75, why don't you see a crossover point on the next chart?
I suspect that simply because the lines are jammed there. It should be about the same. This is an increase, and this is total state revenue. They are graphing the same thing. It's just a scale issue, I think.
Well, and part of my confusion, Mr. Chair, if I could continue. Part of my confusion is that in these normal ranges of a price of a barrel of oil, and I'm going to define normal as something less than $100 a barrel, if I look at page 8, I see kind of the trade-off, that at the lower end of the range of a barrel of oil, that Senate Finance has a little bit more risk, because, and I'm assuming that's because it starts at 0.22 or 22.5. But then I see the upside of the Senate Finance being at prices above $75. But if I tried to make that same assumption on the chart on page 9, it's much more difficult for me, because I see the tracking almost identical throughout that chart.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, and then you'll see that the crossover here on page 10 occurs. It's the one problem here is that you look at these charts and it looks like these lines are virtually on top of themselves. But if you took this change in revenue at any point here, the difference between PPT and ACES, which appears to be quite small, that's actually about $400 million. So it's scale, it's location on the curve, but I agree with you. I'd have to go back and look at this, because this was graphed, you know, just before this meeting started, and it may be that there's an older version or something that got caught in there.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Right. And we'll go ahead and we'll check that. We also have Econ 1 running these same scenarios, and we'll be bringing those forward, and we'll have them come forward with the table like we had in the previous presentation with the dollars on it, so we can deal with some of the nuances. Senator Thomas, your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, the obvious differences here are the base rate and the progressivity, but are there other things that may have some impact in here that if we're not considering them as being equal, say the TAPS language, and are there other things that you can think of? I realize there are a lot of credits and deductions that are happening one way or another, but are there some specific items that you see that have an impact here that we should probably be looking at, as well as simply the base tax rate and the progressivity?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas. As Econ 1 showed, their lines for the Senate, for the House bill and Senate judiciary, don't lie exactly on top of them, each other. And that's primarily because they estimated a cost to that operating cap. I left it out. As Barry Pulliam said, he didn't have 06 data to do anything. They made an estimate. I just said, it's a snapshot here. If we had a time series, you would probably see that operating cap having a fairly large effect in the out years, because that 3% inflation is just keeping up with costs. And as we've seen at higher oil prices, the operating costs of both capital costs can increase substantially. So by capping those deductible charges, you could actually have a larger impact than I can model, because again, all I'm looking at is a snapshot. I can't go out 5 years or 10 years here and say here's what would happen. There are also issues of production volumes and you know, the operating costs, the credits and the delays, those sorts of things that do affect these models, if you could model them well. But you're really looking at wanting a time series rather than a simple snapshot of 08 revenue.
Thank you.
I had contacted Ledge Finance before we started this special session and wanted them involved in this process. At the last go around of PPT, they weren't really involved in the analytical end of the PPT creation, and with the issue of the operating and capital expenditures being frozen in time as we had these huge price movements, I had a couple extra set of eyes on the data doesn't hurt us. So that is why Ledge Finances has been involved in working with progressivity. Now, we're going to have, when we go forward here the next day or so, we'll be having Econ 1 do their standard runs on this progressivity scenario, which will make it a little easier to compare, because it is true that when you have charts that have billions of dollars running up beside, one of them was increments of $5 billion running up the y-axis, when the lines look like they're almost on top of each other, we could actually be looking at hundreds of millions of dollars. We'll work on drawing some of that stuff out. Any other questions, Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Are you implying, Mr. Chairman, that the changes we're going to see in the CS are largely on the base rate, trigger point, and progressivity? Or will there be other changes?
There's other changes, of course. But the issue before us right now is progressivity, and the progressivity that you'll see in the CS is what we have presented in front of you today, with a trigger at 30 and the multiple triggers thereafter. I just wanted to get the information out because I am concerned about the calendar, and I want to give everybody ample time to review it along with their staff. Any other questions before we fold up tonight? Well, thank you, Mr. Teal, for your presentation. We're going to go ahead and come back here at 10 a.m. tomorrow, and we'll continue our work. Just a second, we'll stand at brief at ease. So 10 o'clock is the target time. We're going to try to meet it, just depending on drafting and so on and so forth. So anyway, have a good evening. Meeting adjourned.